I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Today is a heavy day with a heavy heart. I say that... to quote him, that those of us who lived through the 60s and 70s and 80s realize there's no such thing as paranoia. It's all true. Hunter S. Thompson is dead at age 65 or 67, Mark Riley.
Good morning. Yeah, it depends on which media you read.
Blew his brains out in Aspen. Died at his own hand. This is the king of gonzo journalism, certainly a hero of mine. When I heard that he died this morning, there are certain people, Riley, in my life, you know, I don't know, it's different for everybody, but he was one of those great adventurers of drugs, of the mind, of the truth. You know, he was a guy that, you know, like when I was a kid, the first time I got hold of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, for some reason I was in like seventh grade. I had no idea what to make of it, but, you know, he became sort of an icon in my mind. And these guys, especially when someone like Hunter S. Thompson kills himself on President's Day, it's a symbolic thing. I don't know if he was sick or if he, you know, did this because he was ill in a way other than being an alcoholic or a drug addict. But this was one, to me, one of the funniest guys to ever write. I mean, you know, outside of Mark Twain, this dude, in terms of cutting to the truth and finding hypocrisy and doing it in a lyrical, funny, poetic way, was just a real hero of mine. And it's when these guys die like this, you know, you got to ask yourself, you know, what the hell does that mean, that Hunter S. Thompson shoots his head off?
Well, I first started reading Hunter Thompson in high school in the late 1960s, reading his stuff from his dispatches that were printed in Rolling Stone prior to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, in fact. And for me, Hunter Thompson was a logical extension of a lot of guys I was reading at the time, including people like Pete Hamill and Norman Mailer, and Jimmy Breslin, who were doing a different kind of journalism, but a very personalized style of journalism. And Hunter Thompson just took that, for me, to its logical conclusion. A guy who really could tell a story about himself with a level of frankness that most journalists would not touch with a 20-foot pole. Certainly, guys like Breslin and guys like Hamill wrote with a personal style, but Hunter Thompson, to some extent, became the story of the things that I used to read that he would write in Rolling Stone. And he was one of those guys you could just sit there and literally feel yourself in his story. And that was a unique quality.
I mean, he's out of his mind, you know. I mean, and that was the great thing. He was out of his mind, but so in his mind at the same time. And incredibly lyrical and poetic. And the thing that really resonated with me was hilarious. The dude was hilarious. Is that, you know, at the core of all his writings, at the core, even with all the drugs and all the frank discussion about being high and all the sort of weird Rimbaud-esque symbolism that used to plow through his brain, you know, when things, you know, peeled apart into lizards and novas and everything else, that there was a legacy of drug use that, you know, comes down through the Beatniks, through William Burroughs, and a type of drug imagery that he drew from that, you know, was beyond psychedelic because he went to the dark side. This was also one of the great drug warriors who didn't toe the hippie line. I mean, this was not a cat who was looking for enlightenment through drugs in the same way that the hippie movement was. This was not a cat who was, like, looking for nirvana. You know, he was a guy that said, look, man, you know, we live in a dark world. You know, this is, you know, we have to go into the darkness and take it apart for what it is.
Well, I mean, he was, I guess, essentially looking to get high. I mean, I remember reading, and it wasn't just the drugs, it was the alcohol. It was creating, I think, at some point, his own space, his own sense of reality, and being able to share that reality with people who, through it, began to develop their own sense of reality. It was an amazing facility that the man had. And I read something from his son, Juan Thompson, saying essentially that the family really wants privacy at this time, that they don't want to get into any kind of the gruesome details. Apparently it happened last night, did it?
So it was over President's Day weekend. It wasn't exactly President's
On
Day.
On President's Day.
I was looking for symbolism.
But, you know, this is the day at 3:10 p.m. this afternoon that Malcolm X was assassinated.
Right.
This was February 21st, 1965, so it will be 40 years since Malcolm X, a very different person than Hunter Thompson, but certainly a figure in American history. was very brutally murdered on stage at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights here in New York City. I knew his widow, Betty Shabazz, very well. She used to do a radio program on WLIB with me at one time. And it was amazing to see and to hear from her what it was like to be there that day and to see your husband gunned down in front of you and your children. It was really a traumatic time, and the Shabazz family went through a great deal of trauma afterward. But, yes, Malcolm X, 40 years ago today, was assassinated.
Mm.
It's an amazing, amazing thing to think about. But back to Hunter Thompson. Hunter Thompson, I think at a point when we start looking at his legacy, at what he's going, what his contribution to future generations is going to be, I think it really has opened up a particular style of journalism that others perhaps have perverted. Because Hunter Thompson was a truth teller, no matter how else you try and slice what he did. It may have been his unique truth, but he didn't lie about anything.
Well, this is an interesting thing about Thompson was that, you know, in talking about the sort of the hippie, non-hippie schism when it comes to drug use, you know, he said so much for objective, what did he say? No, what Leary took down with him was the central illusion of a whole lifestyle that he helped to create, a generation of permanent cripples, failed seekers who never understood the essential old mystic fallacy of the acid culture, the desperate assumption that somebody, or at least some force, is tending to that light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? So he's also crediting Leary, I guess, later in life for helping dismantle the hippie illusion of hallucinogenic nirvana. You know, because I think the way that that Thompson used drugs was to facilitate his own outlaw presence, you know, and to make it to ground his outlaw presence, and then to get into the darkness of stuff. And some of the stuff he said about journalism, especially in relation to people like this Gannon problem,
uh-huh.
Just the idea of what is journalism, what is objective journalism, what does the blogosphere mean to journalism, you know, what about a guy like Gannon who gets access to the president who is not even a journalist and not a journalist, but, you know, a fraud and just a stain on the world, that guy, in terms of misleading and misguiding and misrepresenting the truth. But when we come back, I got a couple of quotes from Hunter on journalism. We're also going to get into we got a pretty interesting show today. We've got Mick Ware from he's going to be talking to us from Beirut about many things, Iraq, Syria, Israel. There's a lot of stuff that we need to go to him with because he's our guy, the Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief, a regular guest on our show, and he's going to bring us some wisdom and insight. We've got a little fragment of our dinner at Danielle that
at
we
Daniel, yes,
me and Riley out of our league entirely, brought to the finest restaurant in New York by food critic Alan Richmond. We got a little bit of that, and we also have Alan Keyes' daughter, Maya
Marcel Keyes,
who is just, you know, coming out in a lot of ways. You know, this is her first time on Air America. She's now you know, out of the closet and talking about her relationship with her husband as her father. Wow, interesting slip. I hope that she would never make that slip. But about you know, being gay and being the son of someone as strange and extremely right as Alan Keyes. Yes?
You mean daughter, don't you?
Daughter, yes. Did I say it again?
You said son.
What the hell is wrong with me?
Not to worry.
No, I mean, now I'm worried. Maybe I got problems. But I'm excited to talk to her. We'll be back. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition.
We've got our highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 19 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Fairly somber morning. Trying to, you know, at least look at some of Hunter S. Thompson, his life, which I don't have any of the books in front of me, unfortunately. I found out in the middle of the night that he had killed himself yesterday out there in Aspen with one of his many guns. It's a very sad thing when a warrior of truth such as Thompson was kills himself, especially given the climate now. I don't know really why he did it. It may have been depression. I don't know if he was battling with an illness. I don't know. Usually to make a decision like that. He just struck me as somebody that would fight the darkness as opposed to give into it unless there was something horrendously wrong either in that moment or on a physical level. But in an article from Salon Magazine, an interview that he did not long ago, they asked him if he had any regrets, and I enjoy this quote. I just read it for the first time this morning. Quote, that goes to the question of would you do it again? If you can't say you'd do it again, it means that time was wasted, useless. The regrets I have are so minor. You know, would I leave my Keith Richards hat with the silver skull on it on the stool at the coffee shop at LaGuardia? I wouldn't do that again. But overall, no, I don't have any regrets. End quote. The only thing that he could think of in the entire history of his life being where he'd been was like, damn, that hat, man. I love that hat with the skull on it, man. That was great. Here's the dictionary. Do I have that in front of me? The dictionary definition of gonzo in relation to Hunter S. Thompson I kind of liked as well. This is the second definition of gonzo, adjective one, with total commitment, total concentration, and a mad sort of panache. Two, more loosely, overwhelming, outrageous, over the top, very large, especially used of collections of source code, source files, or individual functions, has some of the connotations of Moby or Harry, but without the implication of obscurity or complexity. What?
Moby?
I don't know. I got to look up Moby now. But anyways, man, I'm just so sad because, like, this dude, like, the pigs are out of the tunnel was one of his quotes. He had a lot of great quotes, but a lot of great writing. I recently reread Hell's Angels, and, you know, he was just so damn funny and so damn truthful.
Well, he was one of those people. One of the things that really surprised me about Hunter Thompson was how quickly his style of journalism, gonzo journalism, if you want to call it that, was accepted not necessarily by the journalistic community, but certainly by the people who read his work. Rolling Stone, I mean, you know, people would buy Rolling Stone just to read Hunter Thompson. They wouldn't read the reviews. They wouldn't read some of the other people who ended up being quite famous, who wrote in Rolling Stone at the time. They would read Hunter Thompson because his narratives were just so extraordinary.
And people, like, you know, I know that out there in Aspen, he used to hold court, like, you know, people like Johnny Depp, Jack Nicholson, cats from, you know, some of the bad boys of Hollywood and of literature would fly out there to hang out with Hunter and party at his place. He was one of those guys where I'm sad that I never met the guy. Certainly not in his, you know, I'm sad that I meet him in his prime, but I'm sad I never had the opportunity to meet him or to hang out with him, especially certainly when I was still doing drugs. That would have been kind of a fun place to hang out. But here's some quotes of his about journalism. Quote, so much for objective journalism. Don't bother to look for it here, not under any byline of mine or anyone else I can think of, with the possible exception of things like box scores, race results, and stock market tabulations. There is no such thing as objective journalism. The phrase itself is a pompous contradiction in terms.
Well, he's right about that.
Here's another one. Quote, objective journalism is one of the main reasons America has been allowed to be so corrupt for so long. Here's another one. I've spent half my life trying to get away from journalism, but I am still mired in it. A low trade and a habit worse than heroin. A strange, seedy world full of misfits and drunkards and failures. Now you gotta love that guy. In a nation run by swine, all pigs are upward mobile, and the rest of us are bleeped until we can put our acts together. Not necessarily to win, but mainly to keep from losing completely. Ah. Brutal. See, there's the seeds of why, you know, those kind of moments where, you know, where he hits on that truth, where you realize the slippery slope towards darkness that could lead to taking an action like yesterday. Here's something he said about Republicans in an interview. Quote, they get control of the U.S. economy. They get their friends rich. These are not philosopher kings we're talking about. These are politicians. It's a very sleazy way of using the system. One of the problems today is that what's going on today is not as complex as it seems. The Pentagon just asked for another $14 billion more in the budget, and it's already $28 billion. This is a while ago, but it's within this administration. I'm out not quoting. Here's the rest of the quote. That's one sector of the economy that's not down the tube, so some people are getting rich off of this. It's the oligarchy. I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth. That's a great Hunter S. Thompson line.
Later this morning, we'll be talking with the daughter of one of those type of Republicans, Alan Keyes. Who, if you look at his history, some might say it is defined by exactly what Hunter S. Thompson wrote that you just quoted.
Yeah, he says, quote, the GOP is the party of capital. It's pretty basic, and it may have something to do with the deterioration of the educational system in this country. I don't think Bush has the slightest intention or concern about educating the public. obviously. See, but that's a classic line. That's a classic Hunter S. Thompson line, a recent one. I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I like that guy. It's funny, it's cutting, it's to the point, and it's elevated a little bit. A tribal myth. What a beautiful thing, man.
I wonder what kind of memorial service they're going to have for him. I wonder if those guys, the Johnny Depps, the Jack Nicholsons, if they'll all come to, assuming that they have some kind of service for him. I don't know if they will.
Yeah.
The family seems to be very close-mouthed about that, but I wonder what kind of service that would be.
Well, you think like Hunter, you know, like even in my head, you know, we were talking about like, what are we going to do today? I mean, you know, it's not like the president, it's not like, like, well, he, you know, the truth of the matter is that it was amazing. Kent the Colonel Jones, Brendan P.W. McDonald, you know, you have recollections, you know, Riley has recollections of how this guy made him feel. This guy sort of transcended something. He was really an original, an authentic character who created a voice that resonated with a lot of different people. Because it was the voice of the renegade, the outlaw, the sort of, you know, drug-addled cynic who saw the truth through the darkness and through the BS.
But also an exposer of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And certainly when he began in the late 1960s, there was plenty of it to go around. And he was really, you know, he made no bones about saying what he felt needed to be said with regard to American politics at the time and forward. I mean, he's been, you know, through everything, remarkably consistent in terms of his own vision. Dark though it may have been, he was remarkably consistent.
And hilarious. I mean, I'm sure that everyone listening has read him, but if you haven't, you know, you just, I mean, start at the beginning. Read Hell's Angels before he really cracks his nut open, you know, on drugs. It's just an incredible, intuitive, sociological sort of profile of the Hells Angels at that time. It was 1967 he wrote that. Still funny, but not the same over-the-topness, but leading towards it. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the classic.
Yeah.
A great book. Mind-blowing. Just mind-blowing. But the one that really made him a political monster is Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, because he tore Nixon.
A few new ones. Several.
So what do we got coming up there, Riley?
Well, of course, we've got Ramon, who's dropped off the Palm Pilot. We're going to talk a little bit about social security. Why does the NAACP and Wall Street have a problem with Bush's privatization plan? We'll get to that and a whole lot more when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Oh, the passenger, he rides and he rides. He sees things from under glass.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition program. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition, don't be stupid. Feels like thinking. Huh? Doesn't it? Feels like thinking. It's Monday morning, relatively somber morning. Hunter S. Thompson is dead at 65 or 67. It's not clear to us exactly how old he was, but it's somewhere in the realms of 65 or 67. Took his own life in Aspen. Sad day. For fans of the truth, fans of just the
fans of pushing the envelope,
renegade sort of you know, drug-addled, you know, warrior thinking man, God, I'm gonna miss that guy. Even though he wasn't, you know, what he used to be, you know, as of late, you know, but even the stuff that he wrote on for ESPN, some of that stuff was like really got the punch. You know, a couple good lines, man. The guy, you know, as a comedian, you know, and as somebody who writes funny stuff, man, he could really turn a phrase, dude.
Oh, no, he was always good at that. Throughout his career, he was consistent that way.
Unbelievable. So Ramon brought this in. This is the Palm Pilot for day. He was wearing a Napoleon outfit. 8 a.m., wake up.
Who's it?
It is George Bush's Palm Pilot.
Who?
George Bush, the president. President George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today. Here's a schedule. Thank you, Kayla. I didn't want to put that out there. Could have been anybody's. You know what I mean? 8 a.m., wake up. Charm offensive begins. Pay European gay prostitute / reporter to ask me softball questions all week. 9:40 a.m., courtesy call with the king and queen of Belgium, Brussels. Ask them what it's like not to have term limits. 10:15 a.m. Meet with the Prime Minister of Belgium, Brussels, as they sign a transatlantic solidarity. Tell him that Congress has voted unanimously to rename French fries Belgian fries. Then ask him to send troops to Iraq. Now, send them. 11:10 a.m. Meet with the Secretary General of NATO. Tell him we have something similar in the States called NASCAR. A few more letters, but N-A, yeah. 3 p.m., unpack red, white, and blue presidential parka for trip to Bitburg. Nice, yeah. Make an impression. 7:05 p.m., dinner with French President Jacques Chirac, Brussels. As a sign of transatlantic solidarity, tell him that Congress has voted unanimously to rename Belgian fries French fries and ask him to send troops to Iraq. Come on, Chirac, Iraq, do it. 10 p.m., bedtime. Try to get the sound of millions of Europeans booing out of my head. Maybe some pot would help.
Ooh.
That's right. Yeah, maybe some pot. Yeah, you know, we got a little, that interview with the president, the candid tapes.
The candid
that we will,
tapes.
We will get to later about, yeah, I smoked a little pot, but I'm not going to talk about it. I don't want the kids to think the wrong thing.
Right.
It's a hell of a rationalization. But you know what? Sadly, it is the one that many grown-ups use. There's a knowing laugh from Mark Riley.
I don't know anything about it.
All right, so let's get into this Social Security new revelations on the horizon. NAACP says, screw you, Bush, right?
Well, yeah, he's actually the head of the NAACP, Julian Bond, the chair, says that Bush's privatization scheme would disproportionately hurt blacks. And, Mark, we've talked about this before. The fact of the matter is that twice as many blacks as whites rely on Social Security.
Right, but isn't this the appeal? I don't want to interrupt you, but he appealed to them basically by saying, come on, you guys die younger.
Yeah.
You know, why wouldn't you be on board with this?
And it would help because, of course, his scheme would help because blacks have a shorter life expectancy. And, of course, that also provoked a firestorm of criticism because the Bush administration doesn't do a whole hell of a lot to speak to the disparity in life expectancies between blacks and whites. But the fact is that among married couples, twice as many blacks as whites rely on Social Security for their entire retirement income. All of it. 100%. I think among all blacks, I think the number is something on the order of 44 to 45% rely primarily on Social Security for their retirement income. And subjecting this income to risk is something that certainly a lot of people in the black community have a very serious problem with, and that Julian Bond is actually articulating here. He says, and according to Hillary Shelton, who's the bureau chief of the NAACP in Washington, this proposal is extremely dangerous to us. Bush says, of course, blacks die earlier and would not have to wait until retirement to receive benefits. And by the way, blacks in their 50s, and this scared the bejesus out of me when I saw it, blacks in their 50s are twice as likely to become disabled as whites.
Oh, my God.
Twice as likely. Now, according to Bush, that's a reason to go, well, hey, you know, our privatization scheme would help you because you'd be able to collect the money. Never mind getting to the root cause of why blacks become disabled in their 50s at twice the rate of whites.
Right. Well, none of this even approaches the root cause of any of those problems. You know, and we're not even getting into, you know, the number of uninsured in the black community, that, you know, and how, you know, Medicare and Medicaid works. But this is just him basically saying, the way he tries to pander to the black community is a little disturbing, is it not, Mark? I mean, between this and the gay marriage and buying off black clergy members, it's disturbing.
Well, it's disturbing because what he's doing, and I will give Bush the benefit of the doubt that he does have a particular affinity with some black people. He had Colin Powell in his administration as Secretary of State. He's brought Condoleezza Rice in. He has blacks at every level in some Rod Page, you know, a host, a raft of different black conservatives have found a home in the Bush administration.
Okay.
But his policies, when you talk about the mass of black America, his policies are seen as detrimental.
Yeah.
To the larger black community. Now, what that also implies is that the larger black community has a problem with some of the people that have been elevated during the course of his administration. Not necessarily Colin Powell, but, you know, Condoleezza, racism was just a hiccup. Rice is someone that some black people do have a problem with, philosophically.
Right.
Okay? And what Bush is trying to do in terms of all of these, I guess what you would call charm offensives toward the black community, is to use these several fronts. Education, because he knows polling, and Karl Rove will be the first one to tell you this. Polling says that the black community is split on the issue of school vouchers, something Bush supports.
Yeah, and it's just fascinating to me that, like, you know, he would come at it with, like, you know, it's how he could charm the idea of saying, look, you guys die younger.
Mm-hmm.
So why not throw your money on number five now? You know what I mean? I mean, why not live a little and let's see what happens? And, you know, and not only is the NAACP against Social Security for justified reasons, but the people on Wall Street are not coming out in direct support of it because they don't want to, you know, risk what their stance is. They say that, you know, it's going to be a tremendous amount of trouble for them to manage the new investment and to manage all these new fees, which they say are even less than what they would make normally.
Yeah, they say they are less than what they'd make, and they're also afraid that a long downturn in the financial markets will cause many of these, remember, these will be private small investors who will be involved in this scheme. They would be opting voluntarily to put their money in this stuff, and they're afraid of lawsuits. Remember, a lot of Wall Street firms have had to pay out big money, and some of their people have gotten led away in handcuffs for overhyping certain stocks. Now, what happens should that take place with people's Social Security money? They don't want to have to, risk a public relations disaster.
So they're sitting tight on it. So we're going to come back. Maybe later in the show we'll talk a little bit about how the Swift Boat veteran people, the publicity firm behind the Swift Boat for Truth veterans ads are now getting involved with some Social Security ads, so they're going to make, you know, the NAACP look like try to make them look like a bunch of unqualified seniors. How do you do that? That's not going to be tasteful.
No.
We're going to be back. We're going to play a little bit of our dinner at Daniel after this. It's 43 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Seven past the hour. I meant to say AARP before, not NAACP. AARP is going to be attacked by the publicity firm that did the Swift Boats for Truth ads.
Yeah.
To try to make them look uncredible. Uncredible? Disingenuous? What is the word if you're not credible?
They're trying to break them down.
There you go. All right. So that's going to happen.
Yeah.
There's the agenda from the Streisand compound, but it's not from the Streisand compound for today. It's from the Hunter S. Thompson compound. Rest in peace, Hunter. Here's some phrases to drop into conversation from the doctor, Hunter S. Thompson himself. One, call on God, but row away from the rocks. Two, the edge. There's no honest way to explain it because the only people who really know where it is are the ones who have gone over. Three, I have a theory that the truth is never told during the 9 to 5 hours. Hey, that means we're under the radar. Yeah. Four, America, just a nation of 200 million used car salesmen with all the money we need to buy guns and no qualms about killing anybody else in the world who tries to make us uncomfortable. And five, I hate to advocate drugs, alcohol, violence, or insanity to anyone, but they've always worked for me.
There you go.
Rest in peace, Hunter S. Thompson. We're going to miss you, man. So here's a little weird segment we're going to do. Look, you know, we got a buddy, Alan Richman, who is a food critic. His book, Fork It Over, The Intrepid Adventures of a Professional Eater, was nice enough to actually set us up at Daniel, which is really the nicest restaurant probably in the world.
Yeah.
I would never go there. I went there once years ago, but it was a very special occasion. I think maybe a pre-engagement with my, I don't remember why I was there, but I was there. Yeah. I remember it was a tasting menu. You know, I'm. You know what's screwing me up right now is I don't remember which. I'm gonna get in trouble. So here's Riley and I went with Dan Pashman and Brendan McDonald and Alan Richmond, and we were way outgunned in terms of the class. But just I didn't even know how to behave at this place. And we've got several excerpts from our dinner at Daniel, and this is Riley and Marin's dinner at Daniel.
Alan Richmond. This is I've never felt intimidated at a restaurant before. Maybe I have, but I feel intimidated. Me and Mark Riley here, we're up late. I mean, this is a big night for us.
Yeah, you mean you're staying out past 7:30?
Yes.
This is exciting.
Staying up later than my daughter.
But I just realized, why I don't come to restaurants like this very often. Aside from, it's $500 for a meal. But, I don't want to sign at the cheapskate. But look, I walk into this place. I was afraid my Old Navy label was going to show on my scar.
No. I'm quite shocked. I mean, you guys, despite your disparaging yourself, I actually think that you both look actually quite lovely tonight. I have to say that. I mean, I feel a little bit like I've stepped into the Beverly Hillbillies coming here with you guys, but you do.
I was brought up well.
Well, so were they, but they're just not used to this kind of setting. And I mean, you still don't know what to do with your napkin yet, do you? You're supposed to take the napkin off your plate.
Alan, when Danielle came out,
Yes.
I never got this feeling. I've met a lot of people before, but I thought I was talking to a general. I didn't know if there was protocol, if I was there. And this is the guy, the chef. When he saw Riley, he immediately said that Puffy came.
Puffy came.
If he has any sort of contempt for you, it's only because we had to put a special menu together.
But you've created an obstacle course for them, Riley.
Well, they love challenges. They really do.
That's why we're back here in the corner, Riley.
I still feel like an oil sheet. What can I tell you?
We got our own tent here. Is this like a beach house or a cabana? What do you call it? You walk into this place. First of all, there's like the seating room where you have the bar. It's closed off. You can't even see the restaurant. It's just like a foyer almost, right?
Right.
And there are these big doors. And all of a sudden, you open the doors, and there's this whole other world that opens up with like 20 guys in suits all standing around with curtains and plants and high ceilings. There's a man standing with a bottle of wine right now as we speak. It's Philippe.
Good.
I got a feeling this is going to be like known in Air America history as the Night Mark relapse. No, I really can't. And by the third bottle, I'm like, what the hell? What's it going to hurt?
Why not ruin your life? It's worth it for a good dinner.
Again. Look at what's coming out now. What do you call that, Alan?
This is the amuse bouche.
Yeah.
We have three tiers of canapés.
Okay.
And I call it a lot of stuff.
This is a pre-meal cookie?
Looks like foie gras. Is that foie gras?
That's correct.
Oh, right. With huckleberry coulis, foie gras, with huckleberry, and what's here?
Eggplant, caviar, quenelles.
Ooh. Wow. What's a quenelle?
Quenelle is like a little gefilte fish.
Oh, okay. What is that?
A gooey duck.
A gooey duck is a clam.
Okay.
You ever see those clams that have these monstrous long tongues sticking out? That's what that is, gooey duck.
Oh, here comes some words. Everything is so so delicate and served in such precious little things. How long what is the allotted time for looking at it and going, ooh.
Oh, whoa.
Here comes another tray.
I'm sorry to interject, but I think if we don't start eating soon, we're going to run out of room on the table.
Here comes something else.
One more is coming.
What is that?
No, don't take that away.
That's it. Here we go. Let's get on with it.
Can you smell the truffles? Can you smell the truffles?
Sure, Alan.
Come on. I can smell the truffles.
You got it, Riley?
Yeah.
You going to give it a try, buddy?
Yeah, man.
All right.
All right. Adventures.
It'll probably be very delicate.
You like it, Riley?
Not bad.
Oh, good. This is going to be an entire evening of me going, are you okay, Riley?
You okay?
You like it?
All right. Yeah. It's okay.
And then what do we go here? This was the... eggplant caviar.
And he called it a quenelle.
Quenelle, okay. I was trying to fake it. Guys, no.
That has a black truffle on it. So
okay, I'm going in.
It costs hundreds of dollars an ounce for black truffles. White truffles are even more expensive, but I like the black truffles from France.
I want to say to our listeners, Riley has eaten everything so far.
Yeah.
Except for the foie gras. Not only the liver.
You didn't even try, but we're very proud of you.
I don't usually like goat cheese. But I tried it this time, and it was quite good.
This is so funny. Do people get hooked to this kind of food? Are there people that are like, I just need one more meal, man. I swear to God, I'll pay you. I'll be back tomorrow. Come on. You can't do this to me.
So, okay, in the canapé division of French food. We have just eaten the best in the world. What do you think?
We just ate some. This is the best in the world, arguably. There's no argument.
I don't argue with it. I think in this, I don't know anybody who does it better.
My only point of reference is crappy buffet canapés at weddings and events. You know,
Sunday brunch buffets. You know,
Sunday brunch buffets or events I have to go to for show business.
What's wrong with Sunday brunch buffets? Plenty of dry white turkey at Sunday brunch buffets.
Now, this guy's role here, the guy that's bringing the food out, is he like a lieutenant? How does it break down? I want to know more about the protocol of this whole thing. Because I know after you reach a certain level of class, like, you know, Sonder Renstone could probably come here in his underpants. I mean, let's be honest.
No,
okay,
about,
how about Henry Kissinger?
No,
he
no,
come here in
you
his
know
underpants.
What?
Snoop Dogg?
About a year.
He always comes in his at least you can see his underpants. You know, you mean?
Great restaurants are democratic institutions.
Okay.
Democratic in the sense that everybody is treated equally well at a great
mm-hmm.
restaurant.
Okay.
Now, there may be... You know who the people who are treated better in a great restaurant? Mm. The people who are regulars may be treated even better.
Sure.
But not the people who are rich are generally treated even better.
Ask Dan Patrick. He has a drinking problem, and he's very well known in many bars in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Do you get treated better?
It's true.
Yeah.
It is true, yeah.
I am amazed that after every course, you know, like 5 or 10 guys converge on the table.
Right.
Like, you don't even realize it, but there are 4 or 5 men that just took all of our plates and are resetting the table as we talk, and I don't even notice it. I don't even know that guy's right here. He's invisible. I'm just seeing forks float through the air and appear
really,
on the table.
I mean,
glass.
Really.
What's exquisite?
The wine.
Oh,
the wine is really, really good.
Is it really? I mean, how good is it?
I have to say it's really good.
It's really good?
It's really good.
It's quite good.
It's not like throwaway 5 years of sobriety good.
Well, you can have it. You can smell it and see if you're sorry.
Sure, I've met Satan before. Yeah, I know. I know what you're doing. Well, it does smell good. Oh, my God.
What's 5 years among friends?
Yeah, I know. Hey, no one will tell. No one will know, right? You guys will be cool, right?
The wine's saying to you, I'm your friend.
Yeah, oh, yeah, believe me. And then the pot says, I'm your friend. And then Mr. Cocaine comes up about 3 hours from now saying, guess what? You got more friends than you ever thought of.
That's part of the tasting menu.
The cocaine? A plate of blowout, 3 different kinds?
See that? If we were having dinner with Hunter S. Thompson, they would have brought a plate of blowout.
Uh-huh.
There would have been 3 different kinds. That was our dinner at Daniel. You know, look, I got to be, you know, it's when Alan Ritson says they're like $100 an ounce or something, I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I, you know, I'm not the kind of guy who would spend that kind of money on food. And Riley, we didn't know if you were going to eat anything because you're so specific.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, look, this is just a little part of our world. This is me and Riley out in the world.
I had never done anything like this before.
It was really, it was pretty spectacular, and we just wanted to share that with the listeners that like us.
Yeah.
Yes, and just for the record, Dan Pashman does not have a drinking problem yet. I don't want Lewis and Linda Pashman in New Jersey to sit there going, why is he saying that about Dan? No, Dan just enjoys his lifestyle at this point in time.
Absolutely.
We'll see how it pans out. If you want to call us and reflect on Hunter S., 866-303-2270 is the name for all you, is the number for all you Gonzo fans or people who might feel some sadness around the passing of Dr. Thompson yesterday by his own hand. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Edition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, morning's edition, Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. There's no time for you today. The doctor is out. Hunter S. Thompson dead by his own hand today. 65 years old, maybe 67 years old, took one of his many guns from his arsenal of firearms and ended his own life. One of the great warriors of journalism, of drug culture, of renegade disposition, of authentic humanness. This cat was all of it. I mean, he was a tremendous influence on my life. Tremendously cynical and honest and funny writer and iconoclast, Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, dead at 65 or 67 years old. It's unclear right now. 866-303-2270 is the number if you want to remember Hunter S. Thompson publicly. Mark Riley, good morning.
Good morning.
Mark Riley also informed me earlier today is the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. This is a heavy day, man. On top of that, it's President's Day, but I think that some these other things take precedent over President's Day.
I mean, you know, the black community certainly is marking the assassination date of Malcolm X. His birth date actually is May 19th. Mm. A lot of people confuse his birth date and the day he was killed, but it was a very, very sad day for black America the day he was assassinated. I was like maybe 14 years old when that happened.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I wasn't, what year was that?
65.
Yeah, I was 42. I was two years old. And even when Hunter S. Thompson's first books came out, I was too young to really be on board. In 1973, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail came out, and in 1967, Hell's Angels came out. And these are books that, you know, I came to find. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I saw for the first time when I was in like seventh grade. I was wandering around the University of New Mexico bookstore. I saw the Ralph Steadman cover. I picked up this book. I read two paragraphs, and I was like, what is this? Where is this taking place? How does this? I couldn't even wrap my brain around it, so I bought it, and I carried it around for months trying to parse Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas as, I guess, a 13-year-old. And it just blew my mind, obviously. But I was a tremendous fan of Mad Magazine. You know, I was introduced to National Lampoon too young. It was like these are the guiding spirits of my comedic sensibility. I remember when I saw William S. Burroughs on Saturday Night Live when I was a freshman in college. I had no idea that he wasn't the guy that wrote Tarzan. You know, and when I saw William S. Burroughs, I remember sitting there watching it in my dorm room with my autistic roommate who was watching his hands, and I was watching the TV. Yeah, this guy was a trip, and I was watching TV listening to William Burroughs read from Naked Lunch, going, where is this happening? Where is this guy's brain? And they, you know, Hunter and Burroughs sort of came from the same attack zone, you know. William S. Burroughs was not a journalist. He was a visionary, and he was a humorist. You know, he was a moralist, but he was a satirist. And, you know, and Hunter S. Thompson came from this other direction, whereas he hot-rodded journalism to be a cynic and, I think, a satirist on some level. I think you would have to call Hunter S. Thompson a satirist on some level.
See, for me, it was, Mark, coming up during a time when all these things were happening together. The first time I heard Jimi Hendrix, the first time I read Hunter Thompson, the first time I watched Muhammad Ali box, all of these things happened like in a 5-year period of my like preteen and teenage life, and they had a real galvanizing effect on how I viewed the world and what I felt my values were going to end up being. And of course, the Black Power movement, which was grandfathered by Malcolm X, all were taking place in this maelstrom of a time. And of course, 1968 was the Democratic Convention and people out in the streets and Richard Daley. All of these things were taking place within a relatively short span of time. And Hunter Thompson was right in the middle of all of it.
And he was also like, he was the guy that really started to document the crashing of the wave of the 60s. He knew that speed killed the thing and the hate. He knew that, you know, when he wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, that was a real sort of, you know, that was I guess, almost a eulogy for 60s idealism, and what was to enter, you know, the hardcore Nixon period when he did Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. I mean, this was like, you know, I'm going into the darkness. Whatever we thought good was going to happen out of the 60s, all that momentum, even it might have been all BS, and I think in some respects he says it was, now we have to do the hard, cold work of parsing the truth in these dark times, and I'm going to do it, you know, I'm going to blast my brains out on drugs, you know, and cut to the center of this thing. He was a shameless drug user and certainly an inspiration to drug users, you know, around the world, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was the guy that removed the drugs from the hippie ideal, put it into this sort of, you know, cynical, dark mode of attacking the truth, and what he invented, the gonzo form of journalism. Maybe we should take a couple calls. And if you haven't ever read Hunter S., by all means, please, start at Hell's Angels before he became a character. You know, Hell's Angels is really a sort of hands-on sort of journey through the angels, what the angels were built on, what they were made of, who, you know, Sonny Barger, and the early angels. And then, you know, go right into Fear and Loathing. And I'll tell you, one of my favorites is Generation of Swine, which came out as a reflection on the 80s, a series of essays and columns that he published. But there's some great stuff in there. You know, that's where one of my favorite quotes comes from, the pigs are out of the tunnel. I think that goes without saying. And just in this interview that I found on Salon.com of him, you know, recently, He has a great Hunter S. Thompson line, which is, I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth. That's a great example of the way his brain works. Dan, listening to the quake in San Mateo, California, you have any reflections on the good doctor?
I'm in mourning.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I at one time was the night manager at the Mitchell Theater. No, I'm just kidding.
He was. A lot of people don't know that about him. He used to hand out business cards, Hunter S. Thompson. He was the night manager at the Mitchell Brothers Theater on O'Farrell Street in San Francisco, which was a sort of live sex theater. And
it
I think
still
he,
is.
Hey. So,
it occupies a whole block, and it's painted like you wouldn't believe.
I know. I was out there recently. I've been there maybe twice. I went there for a Christmas party once. It was kind of interesting.
You know, the whole thing about it is his early writing is all bloom around here, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
yeah, absolutely.
The Great Highway.
Yeah.
And, your favorite line was the pigs are out of the tunnel.
Yeah.
And that same book, it talks about AIDS. It says all that's left is TV and relentless masturbation.
Yeah. So you're up late.
No, I'm actually in mourning. I heard about it on the evening news, you know, and I was listening to the radio, and I went, oh, man, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
And you know what you were saying earlier? Maybe this is a statement he's saying about, you know.
It's hard when somebody like him does it like that.
Well, I mean, he was a journalist, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he was.
And what's in the news right now about a journalist?
I know.
Yeah, you know, and I drew that same conclusion, but you just said it. That's all, you know.
Yeah, I think we'll certainly find out more as to the state of his life at this time. Hopefully, from the family. I don't. A lot of times, people he might have been suffering from some ailment. I don't know.
It's he's getting older and everything, but you know, I mean, I don't see him as a quitter. You know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
He was a fighter, man. You ever read it? I forget what book it was. He's talking about going to the 68 Democratic Convention
in Chicago. Yeah.
Yeah, let's see. Check my checklist, you know. Motorcycle helmet, check.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Baseball bat, check, you know.
Yeah, he was a fighter. You're absolutely right.
And you know, his whole thing wasn't about, I mean, it was about drugs, but it was about partying hard, you know, and not making any mistakes about it. And I'll tell you what, I took off from that, you know.
Sure.
I'm a little bit older than you.
Yeah.
But I know all my friends, and some of them ain't with us no more, but we all took off after that.
That's
know?
Right. And he was, at, you know, he was on a quest for truth, no matter how dark it might have been.
Hey.
Yeah.
Thanks for what you said.
You bet, man. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for calling, man.
We'll take a few more calls about this. 866-303-2270. We're reflecting on the death of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. He was a doctor, wasn't he? They just call him a doctor.
I think he was a doctor. I'm not quite sure of what. But
we're going to have to find out. I also want to find out when this Salon interview was done. And I would like to read something he said about regrets from that Salon interview when we come back. It's 15 past the hour here on Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Hey, it's 20 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Yes.
You're listening to Air America Radio, and as Hunter S. Thompson once said, the pigs are out of the tunnel. That certainly would apply to the political climate of this country at this point in time. Hunter S. Thompson is dead. He died at his own hand. Is that how you say it?
By
his own hand, with one of his many guns, for reasons that are unknown to us. But it's a sad thing when somebody with the type of fighting spirit and authenticity and that Hunter S. Thompson had dies that way. It hurt me. Hurt my feelings. It made me very sad this morning coming in. And he was a specific type of dude who appealed to a specific type of sensibility. You know, and certainly I think many of our listeners would relate to that sensibility. And we're going to take some more calls here, Mark Riley, when I get done with this dream diary from last night. I'm at the Daytona 500 as a driver. I don't even have a car here. But anyway, I got a Dale Earnhardt mustache. and sponsor patches all over my jumpsuit, but instead of beer logos, mine say science, peace, tolerance, fiscal responsibility, and facts. I got a shiny blue car with a big cartoon of Franken on the hood. In gold script on the side of the words, Liberal Lightning. My pit crew are the guys at the show, Riley, Larson, P.W., Pashman, the Colonel, Wayne Gilman. You all had on Liberal Lightning shirts and Dale Earnhardt mustaches, except for Wayne Gilman, who already had that mustache. Kayla wasn't there because he was driving the Costco car, but I digress. Across from me is a red car driven by Dick Cheney. His jumpsuit has patches on it that say Halliburton, fear, paranoia, superstition, control, and, of course, Viagra. At the starting line, we exchanged hard looks. I say, come on, Dick, let's see what you got. Then the flag comes down, and I tear out, like, those are tires. Okay, so I'm going 186 miles an hour. I'm weaving my way to the front of the pack until I'm wheel to wheel with Cheney. In the stands, Red State neocons were yelling, smash him, Dick! Smash that elitist Democrat for mucking our customs in his ironic, for mocking our customs in his ironic dreams. Cheney tries to bump me into the wall, so I bump him back. This goes on for 2 hours until we're in the last lap, and we're both headed for the finish line. Just as Cheney was about to win, his back tire blows out, and he spins into the infield. He got out of the car, threw his helmet down in a rage, and then suddenly grabbed his chest. As I crossed the checkered flag, I could see someone in my rearview mirror. It was Howard Dean, who was laughing hysterically and hiding a nail gun behind his back. In the winner's circle, I shook up a huge bottle of milk and sprayed it all over everybody, drenching our Dale Earnhardt mustaches. Oh, I wake up and my bed was filled with lucrative product tie-ins. Ooh. I like the part where Cheney clutches his chest.
Yeah, right?
We're taking calls reflecting on the life of Hunter S. Thompson. Any friends of Hunter out there that want to talk to our audience, we'd love to hear that. And we got a guy on the line right now, shared a little time with Hunter S. Thompson. Fred, how are you streaming in Atlanta? What's up, Fred?
Hey, Fred.
How's it going? Yeah, I'm sad. I can't believe it. It's like, what 20 minutes since you announced it that I heard it?
Mm. It's heavy, man.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
I kind of agree. Somebody said earlier it was something physical. Maybe I can't comprehend that he did that at all, knowing how he was.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense completely. And it's one of those things when you know, guys like him or anybody dies from suicide, you know, it's such a giving up of hope. And this guy was such a fighter. So you got a story though, huh?
Well, I guess what I told the fellow on the pre-screen or whatever, I moved out there in 88.
In Aspen?
Yeah, I moved to Aspen in 88.
Mm-hmm.
I knew a bunch of people from the southeast, and I'd previously been living in San Diego, and I'd seen him give a speech, and one of the things I remember, he was talking about Nixon and politics, and, I mean, talk about defining your skepticism of the system when I was, quote-unquote, finding myself after
sure.
college and all that.
Sure.
And I already, I'd read him, it fit right in with what I kind of suspected. You know, I went to a private high school, and, you know, I wasn't of that circle, and it was almost like I didn't have to find out anything about him. He just kind of spoke, he put into words what I thought, you know, sort of.
Sure, he did your groove in your brain, that guy.
Totally, already.
Yeah.
And I, you know, partially because of him, I followed my heart and became a musician and all this stuff, and talk about no regrets and all that.
Mm.
When I moved out there, I had seen him give a talk in San Diego, and I remember him saying, I wouldn't recommend the life of drugs to anybody, but it's worked for me.
Yeah.
And right. That's one thing I remembered. And then I'm out there, and a bunch of girls, about 6 months after I arrived there from Alabama, moved in. And one of them had gone to Tulane and had interviewed him when he was giving his one of his college talk tours.
Yeah.
And she became his little, like the girl with the Mao hat in the cartoon.
Okay.
You know, his translator.
Yeah.
He was literally for like 3 years the girl who he'd be up for 3 or 4 or 5 days and write his column. And, you know, when he talked, you could barely understand, you know, had trouble understanding. You had to be around, you know, get to know him before you could really clearly hear
him. It was sort of, yeah, he kind of, like, it was frenetic.
Yeah,
and
kind of mumble like this.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, she was like the translator in the Doonesbury cartoon,
was,
Duke.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She was
so you
girl.
Knew her, okay.
Yeah. It was crazy. And then, so anyway, it ended up, you know, knowing Ellie, and Ellie kind of fell in love. It was really crazy. She fell in love with him, and he talked to me about that, and We went to Independence Pass with the Continental Divide and hit golf balls at midnight, doing things that, you know, usually were associated with the 60s, say, kind of the movie. I know I'm an Air American. I could probably say anything, but, you know.
So you were tripping out, hitting golf balls with Hunter S. at the Continental Divide in the middle of the night.
With Hunter Thompson.
That's beautiful, man. Thank you for calling us.
Sure, buddy.
Yeah,
take care, Fred.
That's a good image to go out on there.
Wow.
I wish I had that, you know. I mean, it's like some people are going to be critical of our Frank talk about drugs. But you know what? I got to be honest with you people. Frank talk about drugs in terms of, you know, where some of us come from is part of our life. It's part of our who we are. And it defined a lot of the subculture that some progressives come out of. You know, whether you like it or not or whatever the repercussions were and, you know, whatever drugs may be bad about or how bad they can be, it's part of our history.
You can't talk about Hunter Thompson and not talk about the drugs he took.
But I don't mind people talking, frankly, about drugs either. You know, this is like it's important to be honest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what do we got coming up, Riley? We got Mick Ware.
We got Mick Ware, Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief. We're going to be talking to him from Beirut, and he's going to tell us the latest on the Middle East. And there's a lot of things going on.
And morning remembrance on top of Hunter. We have Milt coming in to do the morning remembrance. It's
coming up on 28 past the hour. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hi.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Sort of a holiday-ish feel, a little slow. Monday, President's Day, we are thematically eulogizing Hunter S. Thompson, who died at his own hand, by his own hand, day before yesterday. A little sadness. A lot of sadness. I definitely felt like I was slugged in the stomach this morning. To quote Hunter S. in February 2003, I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth, unquote. Today on the we've been doing our remembrance of Hunter S. Thompson, and now we have Mark Mortensen to cover a couple other ones. Here's morning remembrance.
As the people of the grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh, God, already. You all right?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Samuel Alderson, inventor, dead at 90 years. Sam Alderson, inventor of crash test dummies that are used to make cars, parachutes, and other devices safer, was found dead last week after two disgruntled dummies reportedly rammed his body through the windshield of a 1964 Chevy Corvair.
You need some Kleenex?
It's real cold out. What snowstorm. Family members reassured themselves with the knowledge that Alderson's death will, quote, be an accurate predictor of what may generally happen in the field when 90-year-old skin panels and internal organs eventually lose their tensile strength.
Oh, God.
I got some in my eye. Darn it.
You'll be all right, man.
You got a tissue?
Yeah, here.
Thank you.
This is awful.
Alderson's invention set the industry standard, but sadly, his reputation took a blow in recent times when he insisted his employees use the dummies for his website to conduct what he called important fondle tests.
Oh, no.
Somebody's chopping onions around here. I know it, man. Is there a falafel place around here?
Are you allergic to falafel?
There's a lot of onions. falafel places. What's it doing up here on the 40th first floor?
Maybe someone brought it in for lunch or something.
Okay, don't interrupt me. I got to get on with this. A pioneer in his field, Alderson was the first to measure the traumatic effects of a human spinal column crashing into a tree by making his test dummies go for beer runs with Leif Garrett.
Oh, man. You sad or you feel bad about it?
What's this?
Going around.
Snow. Lawrence Rawl, former Exxon chairman. Lawrence Rawl, chairman and CEO of Exxon Corporation during the Valdez oil disaster in Alaska, died last week at his Fort Worth home, reportedly after his bursting bladder befouled some 6,000 square feet of executive real estate. He killed scores of watery-eyed poodles. Speaking of the poodles, you got one in here. You know how allergic I am to the poodles.
Well, man, you got a lot of allergies.
Yeah,
you?
Well, you know how it is.
Yeah.
Under his leadership, Rawl reduced costs at Exxon by selling subsidiaries, closing service stations, and giving tanker captains longer unpaid cocktail breaks. Remember that Valdez crash?
Yeah, that was a big thing a while back.
It was.
There's still seals covered in oil. With
oh, yeah. It was never ending. Environmental experts estimate that even with the use of high-pressure steam hoses, detergent, and sawdust, it may take years to completely remove Rawl's remains from the living room carpet. Speaking of the carpet, bad for allergies.
Yeah, we got some in here.
A lot of dust mites.
Oh, man, you're a mess.
Yeah. Anyway. This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, who's chopping onions?
Boy, man, you take care of that. All of those things that are wrong with you, will you?
Yeah.
Please.
These earphones are pinching my ears.
Why don't you take them off?
No.
But Doc, it hurts when I do that. You know that joke, don't you?
Huh? You lost me.
Why don't you put your earmuffs on? Do you have earmuffs? Maybe you go outside with some earmuffs or something.
Now you're getting dirty.
Well, thanks, Morris. Well,
thank you.
You take care. It's been a sad day.
Yeah. I know.
And, okay. Take care. Okay. Well, so there's a couple of different remembrances other than the honorable legacy we're paying or the grieving we're doing for Hunter S. Thompson. Now we haven't got Nick Ware on the phone yet. Sometimes it's difficult to get these guys on the phone if they're in the middle of something. God knows what could be going on in Beirut right now. But why don't we talk a little bit about that, Riley? We were talking last week about this new government in Iraq. Anyways.
Yes.
And now there's been some reports that say that Tehran and the clerics of Tehran want to actually, you know, take a lot more control than we even ever speculated, that they might have spies within one of the leading factions within the new Iraqi government.
Actually, it could be both leading factions among both the Dawa and the Skiris. There is a report that quotes unnamed officials in U.S. intelligence as saying that Tehran has given orders to its agents to infiltrate this new government of Iraq in terms of getting into some of the more important ministries of government, the oil ministry, the finance ministry, the public works ministry, and that they ought through that to get the level of influence. And, of course, the Iranians are looking here as an endgame to turning Iraq into a Muslim theocracy. That's
right.
Their endgame. That's what they want. And they figure the best way to do this, again, according to U.S. intelligence, and it's quoted in an article in Newsweek by Mark Hosenball, they're saying the government sources say that there are covert actions that the Iranians are doing, and they actually have gotten internal government documents from Iran that say this is how they plan on achieving that goal.
Well, apparently, if I read this properly, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq is just full of Iranian operatives. Am I misreading that, Riley?
Well, they've always had ties with Skiri has always had ties with the Iranians.
Okay,
so this is not a new thing. What appears to be new is a coordinated plan to influence the government of Iraq on the part of the Iranians.
And on a local level.
On a local level, and, you know, wherever and however they can. Apparently, a lot of these Iranian
agents belong to the Badr Corps. This is a paramilitary affiliate of Skiri.
Mm.
And, of course, Skiri, along with Dawa, are the two major parties that are comprise the United Iraqi Alliance, the UIA, who got the bulk of the seats in the election.
Now, there's some information coming out, some speculation coming out of some of the extreme left in certain respects, saying that, you know, that now Bush set this up. Now, to what end, if we're going to entertain that scenario that this election was fixed in Iraq, how could that possibly be true, you know, given that Iran now is trying to, you know, take over the government on some level?
I don't take much credence in this whole notion that Bush set this up to take place. To set Syria and the Dawa.
No,
it doesn't make logical sense. What seems to be happening on the part of the Bush administration is that they're kind of sitting back and allowing things to take their course, at least through the naming of a new prime minister, which, by the way, has not happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that wait and see attitude seems to be perhaps emboldening the Iranians in terms of their own covert action. Now, the thing that people need to understand as well is that both Skiri and the Dawa Party, during the bulk of the time of Saddam Hussein, were both based in Iran. They were in exile.
Okay.
And the Iranians certainly harbored them and developed very close ties to them. So the Iranians are looking to try and score some points here in terms of, again, creating a Mideast alliance that includes Iraq, that includes Syria, that includes almost by definition Lebanon and Iran, and they will form their own perhaps alliance that will compete, by the way, for oil revenue with the alliance that already exists with Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Dubai, and the Gulf states.
Mm-hmm. And now, is this alliance going to align itself militarily and ideologically, you know, completely against America, do you think?
I don't think so. I think one of the things they will do is ally themselves and certainly sell a lot of their oil to the Chinese.
Okay.
I think that the Chinese will step in and say, okay, well, if this is what, you know, how you want to nurture an alliance. Now, that will scare the Americans in terms of, you know, what kinds of technology is exchanged mm-hmm. Between these places. The last thing America wants to see is even the glimmer of a possibility of Iraq, no matter who their government is, getting nuclear capability. They're scared to death enough of Iran. And Iran, of course, at this point, holds the whole idea of developing nuclear technology as a national birthright. And they don't want to see that, you know, that same philosophy take root in Iraq if they can help it. But if these folks got covert people in all of these different ministries, I don't know how they're going to stop it eventually.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to our listeners. Mick Ware does not seem to be gettable at this point in time. Sometimes it's difficult. As I said, he's in Beirut. We have no idea what's going on there. If we get him later in the show, we will certainly put him on the air. If not, hopefully later this week. When we come back, Mark Riley, I want to talk about Alan Keyes, because we have Maya Marcel Keyes, his daughter, on later in the show, and I want to know more about her dad and why he's so strange and somewhat evil. 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. Morning Sedition is the show.
You.
It's Air America Radio. We are eulogizing Hunter S. Thompson throughout the show. We'll be taking some more calls over the top of the hour. So if you think you got something you want to say or you want to share, you're a friend of Hunter's, or you did drugs with him or hung out with him, drank with him, were influenced by his books or just sad and you want to share it, we'll be taking calls over the top of the hour. So don't go crazy now. Put it together in your head. If you can, put the pipe down, put down the gun, and think about what you want to say. The number is 866-303-2270. I was just reading some stuff about that he talked about in an interview in 2003 before this election. Yeah, it's just it's sad when a guy like him takes his own life. But here's a quote from him from February 2003. I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth. It's great, Hunter S. Thompson, recent Hunter S. Thompson line. Now let's shift gears. Later in the show, Mark Reilly, we have Maya Marcel Keyes, Alan Keyes' daughter, who has recently come out publicly with her lesbianism, and yes. and also come out publicly talking about her relationship with her parents as a lesbian, who she was, I guess, kicked out of the house by Alan Keyes, who, as a Republican ideologue, what would you call him?
A controversialist.
Okay.
That's how he's described in one piece that I have here. And that's probably pretty accurate, truth be told.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Keyes has a long history, actually. He came to public attention when he became what was, in essence, a Reagan administration lobbyist for the apartheid regime of South Africa. Mm-hmm. Now, this was in the mid-1970s. And one thing about Alan Keyes, where Alan Keyes goes, it seems, some money seems to follow. I remember he got a contract, I believe, it was definitely a six-figure contract,
mm-hmm.
To do the South African thing before he got into government. He is known euphemistically as Ambassador Keyes because he spent 11 years with the State Department. He was in the Foreign Service, on the staff of the National Security Council. He eventually became, now listen to this, the ambassador to the United Nations Economic and Social Council. That's not the same as being U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. That means you were ambassador to one council, which means essentially you gave a lot of speeches.
Okay.
And he, I guess, honed his craft while doing that. He was president of Citizens Against Government Waste and founder of the National Taxpayers Action Day. He was a two-time Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate in Maryland. He was also a nominee for the U.S. Senate, Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate in Illinois. That was three runs. He got served all three times, the latest being by Barack Obama. He ran for president
twice.
Yeah,
and he was snuck in there. Yeah. You know, because they didn't know who else to run against Obama. And what's his name, Ryan, got nailed on a sex rap for the most part.
Nailed?
Well, he didn't get nailed.
Right, yeah.
Apparently he liked to go places to watch other people
get
nailed.
Yeah.
But so they stuck him in there, Keyes in there, which was
he got his head handed,
but it was ridiculous, right? Everyone knew.
Of course, it was.
He's ridiculous. He's like a clown, isn't he?
Well, he is a conservative ideologue. What's interesting about Alan Keyes is if you start looking at what was it they used to say, Count de Monet,
mm-hmm.
Count the money.
Count the
money. Alan Keyes' case, Alan Keyes paid himself $100,000 a year out of campaign funds when he ran. For the Senate.
Okay.
And for the president.
Okay.
Okay. Now, this is not technically illegal, but it is rare and it is...
questionable.
Sleazy.
Yeah,
why don't we just say sleazy,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
He also is very interesting in the way he parses what he personally may owe versus what his campaign owes. And this is a quote from Alan Keyes. And this was according to realchange.org. Quote, I personally do not owe the debt that was owed by the campaign. Now, this was an issue because there were some pretty steep campaign debts that came out of virtually every race the guys run. That means, you know, vendors didn't get paid. Different people that had extended him credit to run his campaign never got paid. Now, beyond that, Alan Keyes has made two runs, 1996 and 2000, for the presidency of the United States. In both of those runs, and I was in San Diego in 96 when Alan Keyes was running around calling the Republican Party a group of Stalinists because they wouldn't give him a platform to speak because they wanted to downplay Republican opposition to abortion.
Hmm.
Now, Alan Keyes is staunchly anti-abortion. He is also, and of course we'll get more from his daughter Maya about this, staunchly anti-gay.
Well, now, let me ask you something. In your knowledge of him, in your history of taking this guy in, do you find that, you know, is he sounds like one of those guys where it's hard to know what he really thinks because he's such a contrarian, he's such a self-promoter, he's a provocateur. I mean, is it hard to figure out where he really stands?
No. Actually, it's pretty clear where he stands. The question is, why does he stand where he stands?
And you think it's primarily because he is able to celebrate himself to a certain degree, to be, you know, one of a few people that thinks like him.
He is able to parlay failed runs for elected office. And by the way, Pat Buchanan has been able to do this quite well, too. He's able to parlay that into a thriving media career. Remember, the guy had a talk show on MSNBC. Failed, but he still did have the show.
But he does go against the ideological momentum of the black community. I mean, isn't
that... there's no doubt about that.
And that's why he sort of profits from that. That's his niche. I mean, I'm curious to talk to his daughter about, you know, who he is really, you know, as a person, because he's such an extreme character.
He is an extreme character, and in my judgment, he's shown his extremity by what he's done to his daughter.
Sure.
I have kids, and I would not, under any circumstances, short of, you know, my kid being an axe murderer, disavow my child. I mean, I just can't imagine or envision a scenario where that would take place.
Yeah. It's the number, if you want to call up, we're going to go away in a minute. We are still talking about, by the way, we do have Maya Marcel Keys in the on the phone in the next hour, but we are reflecting on Hunter S. Thompson. The pigs are out of the tunnel, as he said. That was his prophecy, and that has been the truth, certainly for the last two administrations in relation to the two Bush administrations. 866-303-2270. If you want to talk about Hunter S., give us a call. Share your grieving. It's 57 past the hour. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hi.
Good morning. It's 6 past the hour here on Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. I am Mark Maron. This is my friend Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We've been hanging out here for a few hours, a couple hours. It's been a rough morning in a lot of ways. We all walked in sort of in shock. I did anyways. And I know Kent the Colonel Jones and Brendan P.W. McDonald were pretty shook up. Hunter S. Thompson killed himself yesterday for reasons that I for some reason, you know, hope we're deeper than just hopelessness, because when somebody like Hunter S. Thompson, a true fighter, a true visionary in a lot of respects, a guy who had an incredibly perfect cynical sense of humor, kills himself, it's disheartening. You know, he was old, but he wasn't that old. He was somewhere between, you know, either 65 or 67. There were reports of both ages in real sources, so I don't know. But either way, it's not the age that you have to die at now. And, you know, in terms of, you know, his impact on my life, you know, he was one of the great truth warriors and one of the funniest writers I have ever read in my life. So precise, so perfectly adept at turning a phrase. He had a lyrical sensibility, but barring anything else, the dude was funny because it was the type of humor that cut so close to the bone that you could see the bone, and that was the way it should be. You know, even in this one sentence from this 2003 interview about, you know, from Salon, which he just confronts the interviewer, if you want to go to salon.com and check that out. But this is a great example of the way his brain clicks. You know, I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth. You know, it's a great line, you know, and it's new. But obviously, everyone has their favorite Hunter line. Some of them go on for entire books, man. We're going to take a couple of your calls, 866-303-2270, after here, the job listing for today. Because we know a lot of people out there are out of work, and, you know, you're looking for a job. Well, we spent Sunday leafing through the want ads, and we want to help do our part by putting, you know, by presenting here. What am I just babbling for? Here's the Morning Sedition job listing. Needed. Well, wait, let me set this up. A German zoo has imported 4 female penguins from Sweden in an effort to tempt its gay penguins to go straight. The Swedish females were dispatched to the zoo in Bremen after it was found that the 3 of the zoo's 5 penguin pairs were homosexual. So, needed. Ornithologist/gay deprogrammer. There you go. If you are the kind of person who thinks that 2 males dressed in tuxedos performing mating rituals is a crime against nature, the Bremen Zoo may have an opening for you. Our Penguin Island has become the scene of acts that threaten the zoo's ability to raise money from socially conservative donors. Thus, we are looking for someone who strongly feels that skater Scott Hamilton should remain the gayest thing on ice. First and foremost, we need someone who can tell the difference between male and female penguins, at least better than the penguins can. At a minimum, you should be able to determine the gender of the penguins through an inspection process that will not turn them gayer than they already are. If you meet these criteria, or if you fail to meet them but happen to be an extremely sexy female penguin, please, please, please apply soon. And with our man in Baghdad, John Necroponte, being nominated for U.S. Intelligence Chief, his old job is going to be open, and sure enough, we found this. America needs a new ambassador to Iraq. If you would like to be part of spreading America's light of liberty and freedom around the world, if you just think it would be cool to be able to torture people, this could be the job for you. The ambassador's responsibilities include destroying parts of Iraq, rebuilding parts of Iraq, and telling the difference between the two, often on the fly. We're looking for someone who can look credible saying phrases like significant progress and huge strides forward with audible mortar fire in the background. The ideal candidate will be in charge of everything while seeming to be in charge of nothing and appear to be completely in control while actually not being able to control anything. That makes sense to you? Forward your resume to Karl Rove, care of George W. Bush, the White House. I'm a little stumbling then. A little brain skitty. A little consumed with some weird rock and roll grief for the late, great Hunter S. Thompson, who, when asked, do you have any regrets, recently said, that goes to the question of would you do it again? If you can't say you'd do it again, it means that time was wasted, useless. The regrets I have are so minor, you know. Would I leave my Keith Richards hat with the silver skull on it on the stool at the coffee shop at LaGuardia? I wouldn't do that again. But overall, no, I don't have any regrets. Brent, listening to LIB in New York City, good morning.
Good morning.
What's up, buddy?
Doing great, thank you.
Okay.
Really appreciate this opportunity to show a tribute to one of my heroes.
Uh-huh.
When I was 17, I received the book, Varian and Lilian in Las Vegas, for a present.
Mm-hmm.
And it encouraged me to go to a Dead show.
Okay.
A few weeks later in Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And it encouraged me to take some chances, and I'm really glad I took.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's what the power of poetry can do. Now, was that the Dead tour with when they were touring with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers?
No, actually, I think that year, let me remember, that Steve Miller opened.
Oh, wow. So how long did you spend lost in the land of the dead?
Not long, just a couple of years in a row, and the next year Sting opened up.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, I just consider his books like a rite of passage.
Yeah, there's a couple of mind-blowing things. Yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying, Brent. Thanks for your call. That's the weird thing is how powerful certain things, just certain moments, certain texts can be, and it can define your whole life. It's unbelievable. Christine in Madison, Wisconsin, good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
How are you doing?
You miss Hunter?
Yes. This is Madison. I mean, I'm grieving like hell.
Okay. So what's on your mind?
I just wanted to make a quote, one of my favorite quotes from him.
Okay.
All right. Terrible gibberish. No solace for the refugees. No point in looking back. This is the question now.
Absolutely. The question is now, and it's sad that, you know, somebody who was such a fighting spirit for so many people in so many ways, just like he represented an entire lifestyle, an entire way of thinking, and when somebody like that takes their own life, it hurts. Thanks for your call, Christine.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
You know, that is the central point here, that I think a lot of people who were inspired by Hunter Thompson took this very, very personally, as if their whole philosophy died with him.
Well, that's true, you know, when these guys go, you know, but this generation of people, you know, I mean, they a lot of them are going, and certainly he lived a hard life. It's like, you know, this, when they go that way, you know, it certainly throws a lot of things into question, you know.
Yeah, it does.
I think Peter's going to address a little of that. Peter, listening to New York on the net. How are you, buddy?
Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm okay, man.
You know, I heard the story last night. I had just gotten home, and I popped on the internet, and there it was. It was like a 10-minute-old story, and I think a lot of people are looking at it wrong, like he gave up. But my viewpoint on it is maybe it's like the ultimate sacrifice to wake up the weird again, you know, well, get people reading his books and
Well, I hope you're right. You know, I to wake up the weird. Maybe that is what's going on. Maybe it's time for the weird to wake up. At least get some nads. You know what I mean? Thank you, Peter. Thanks for your call. You know, because that's what my wife Nishna said. You know, it's just that, you know, when these guys go, my wife who's you know 12 years younger than me, you know, is concerned about the generation after her.
Yeah.
Who have no way to put Hunter S. Thompson in the context, no way to put anything that happened in the 60s in context, no way to put that fighting spirit, that, you know, standing up against the liars and the hypocrisy, no way to put that into context, because a lot of them, they think that the government should have control of the news. You remember in those recent polls?
Yeah, I saw that poll.
It's a very frightening generation of ciphers that we're producing. 866-303-2270 is the number. We're reflecting about Hunter S. Thompson. If you want to get started with his books, I would certainly start with Hell's Angels and then go to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And then if you're interested deeply in politics as a young person at this point in time, Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail is great. And The Great Shark Hunt, any of the essays. You pick up these books anywhere and you read, you know, two paragraphs and you'll be like, what? What? We'll be back with your calls after this, 15 past the hour.
Join the morning's edition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning's edition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, waking up the weird. It's morning's edition on Air America Radio. That's Mark Riley. I'm Mark Maron. Hunter S. Thompson is dead. He killed himself day before yesterday. Very upset. I am very upset. We've been taking calls about it. People reflecting on the impact he had on their lives. A quick quote from a 2003 interview from Hunter S. Thompson. Quote, I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth. We'll be checking back with you on your calls in just a minute. But right now, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I just bought a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi translator. Let's crank this baby up and feed it some headlines. What do you say, Chris?
Yeah.
Mark Riley.
Where?
Right there, from the New York Times. Insurgents wage precise attacks on Baghdad fuel. Feed that into the machine. Insurgents wage precise attacks on Baghdad fuel. Translation, terrorists to fuel. We hate your freedom. From Fox News, Bush, Clinton visit child tsunami survivors. All right, Bush, Clinton visit child tsunami survivors. Translation, children witness devastation caused by a lifetime in politics. From Reuters, severed penis retrieved from toilet is reattached. I know. Severed penis retrieved from toilet is reattached. Translation, plumber's helper saves man's plumbing. Recovering nicely, feeling flush. Quite a machine that is. Now, we got some tapes. Tell me, like, set up these tapes. These tapes, this friend of Bush, this guy Weed.
Yeah.
Why, he was an operative in the first Bush administration, the father, friend of Bush's, was working on a book, did these series of interviews, has tapes of the young Bush when he was still governor, second term as governor of Texas, if I'm recalling properly. And he talks about drugs. Now, this is the amazing thing is that, you know, Bush, as we know, is the fake Christian AWOL blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult. But if you listen to these tapes, you realize he's a cagey, devious, very manipulating politician, and also a coward. He's a coward to spin the way he spins drug use, to not own up to, you know, what he's, who he really is. Can we hear that soundbite?
I wouldn't answer the marijuana question. You know why? Because I don't want some little kid doing what I tried.
Doing what I tried.
Yeah.
First of all, you didn't try anything. This was years and years of partying like some rich frat boy monkey boy. This was years and years of blow and booze and smoking the reefer, driving around in fast cars, trying to have sex if you could, but you're too jacked up on blow sometimes. I mean, this is the kind of life this guy led, and now it's like sort of like, I don't want to let the kids know what I tried because they might do it themselves. I don't want to make a bad impression. It's disingenuous.
Oh, it's completely disingenuous, but so too is his courting of the religious right, and these tapes, who, by the way, were made by a functionary of the religious right, this guy Doug Weed, essentially put out the notion that George W. Bush saw this as an interest group to whom he had to pander. He did have limits. He said he would not go to them and speak in any specific language about being anti-gay. That he said he would draw the line at. Now, why? I don't know, but we can, you know, leave that to people's minds to imagine. But he did know that he had to reach out to these people, and he did so by, you know, defining a very strong position on opposing same-sex marriage. And he talks to Doug Weed about that. He talks about John Ashcroft in the most glowing terms. I can't believe how glowing he was about Ashcroft.
Well, that's because he knew that guy would never be disloyal. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, he knew that Ashcroft, no matter what, would be his lapdog in all situations, complete loyalty. But I just would rather hear somebody be honest. I didn't like the way Clinton did it either. I didn't like the way Clinton did the sort of like I didn't inhale thing. Own it, for God's sakes. I mean, you know, we live in the 20th century. Sometimes you do drugs. You know, yeah. Sometimes they define you for a long time and then you stop doing them. I mean, this is a reality of being alive in this world. And this is one of the things that, you know, despite, you know, Hunter S. Thompson is dead. He did a lot of drugs. You know, I'm sure they added to his disposition in a negative way. I'm sure they broke down his body, but it was something that he owned and was willing to be proud of, and it defined who he was, and that was his particular renegade outlaw disposition, and that's how he cut his little path through the world.
Well, see, the thing that troubles me about the revelation of these tapes, and the tapes, again, were revealed and done by a guy named Doug Weed, is my first impression, and Mark, we talked about this before we got on the air, I thought Bush set the whole thing up. I really do. I think that he knew that this guy was taping him. I think that he, at some point, knew that they were going to come out. And, in fact, the private Bush is very much like the public Bush.
I completely agree with you, Mark. I don't know why they came out this time. I think they're it's a unique timing. I think this was some sort of weird ace in the hole that he had. He knew that, like, oh, they're presenting it as a revelation, but it's not really a revelation because it sort of enforces who he is. It makes him look like he always had the same things on his mind, and maybe he did, but it seems to be a reaction to the Gannon issue, the Social Security issue. This is just sort of something that's being used to reaffirm him as opposed to make him look bad, and that's I don't like the way they're spinning it to be some sort of revelation. I was just trying to launch off on the drug scene because we got a few more calls.
Oh, yeah.
Here about Hunter. Derek in Memphis, how are you, Derek?
Hey, Derek.
Hey, how you guys doing?
It's all right.
It's very refreshing to hear y'all on the radio. We just got your station out here, and I'm very thankful for it.
Oh, well,
anyway,
thank you
for listening. Thompson, huh?
Mr. Thompson has removed himself from my presence. You know, I'm 31 years old. I guess I'm sort of at the cutoff point of people who are really aware of what this man did.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being exposed to Frank Zappa, writers like Charles Bukowski.
Sure, sure.
The things of this nature. And, you know, it's a real shame.
Yeah, it is. You know, these are defining influences, you know, and you don't know what the hell. It's just mind-blowing when this happens. Thanks for calling, and welcome aboard, Memphis.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, this is the weird thing, is that there's this whole, and I'm assuming that a lot of the people we're talking to and a lot of the people that come from this ilk, there's definitely a type of a person that locks on to these kind of authentic sort of American voices. Someone like Zappa. I mean, Zappa is a whole other world in and of itself, you know, and Hunter S. Thompson, Bukowski, another one. These are people that are not ashamed people. These are honest sort of visionary people.
Well, so, you know, we have an honest person that's coming up, Mark.
Yes, sir.
Maya Marcel Keys, who has decided to come out both as a liberal and as a lesbian. To the wrath of her father, Ambassador Alan Keyes. We'll talk with her about that. And we've got a whole lot more for you when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Fair America Radio's morning sedition program. On the phone with us, in a matter of moments, is the daughter of ultra-conservative politician Alan Keyes. She is a self-proclaimed liberal queer, in quotes, in a good way. And she came out publicly last Monday at a gay rights rally in Maryland, and we're welcoming her to the show. Good morning, Maya Marcel Keyes. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How does it feel to be in the spotlight? It's only been a week, but you've been very popular lately.
Kind of overwhelming, really. I mean, I knew there would be a sort of media reaction, but not this big.
Yeah. Well, I guess that your dad is sort of, you know, he's kind of a provocative figure in this country. And now you came out a couple of years ago before coming out publicly. Now, what happened, you know, since then that made them, you know, kick you out of the house, say?
I guess really just me being more open about it in general, as long as it was sort of a quiet, you know, family thing, they weren't too concerned. But when other people started to know about it, and I started to be more outspoken.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I was asking my co-host here, Mark Riley, in relation to your dad, is that, you know, his public personality is very extreme. It's very, you know, narrow-minded in a lot of ways. It's very restrictive, repressive, and somewhat, you know, off-putting, obviously, and mean in certain respects. But your relationship with him at home is different?
Yeah, I mean, I've usually had a pretty good relationship with my parents. They've, you know, been good parents. They've had a lot of disagreements about my politics and sexuality, and they were really, really upset about that. And so there have been a lot of problems because of that. But before that, it was, you know, normal.
Outside of your sexuality, what political differences have you articulated with your father?
Well, I'm just pretty liberal about most things in general, so we really have a lot. There's not a whole lot of political similarities we do have.
But you are pro-choice or anti-abortion.
Pro-life.
You're pro-life.
Yes, I am.
So
yes.
You share that with your dad.
Yes.
Now, why did you decide to blog, to begin a blog where you did more or less come out?
Well, I've had that blog since I was 14. I've been blogging since, gosh, about the days blogging started when I was in middle school. But that particular blog I've had since I was 13 or 14. And so it wasn't really so much a decision to come out there. I've just had it for a long, long time. It took other people a while to find it and realize that it was mine. I mean, I never specifically said who I was on it, but they found me links to someone else's site who did say who I was, and so that was sort of how it got discovered.
Now, you started at 14. How old were you when you first exposed in the blog that you were a lesbian?
Gosh, I can't remember. Probably I've been mentioning things since I was in high school, so I can't remember the first time I specifically said, but probably years ago.
So now, why the change of heart on behalf of your folks? I mean, it was just because you came out publicly, or well, why all of a sudden would they distance themselves so much from you?
Well, I mean, the sort of conflict there has been growing for some time now, but I guess it was prompted by my decision to be more public about this. And really, the one thing that sort of pushed them over the edge with this whole business was when I went to go protest at the counter-inaugural. They didn't really like that. So it was more to do with my politics in general than specifically my sexuality, even though that has been a really huge factor in everything.
Was there yelling and screaming? Did Alan Keyes proselytize you? Was there, you know, how did it unfold?
No, there wasn't really yelling and screaming. There was more long talks and, there was some proselytizing, but it wasn't angry and yelling and screaming type.
Like what?
Like sitting down and telling me how it's sinful and wrong and immoral, that kind of thing.
Do you believe that?
No, I really don't think that God cares about who you love.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because you obviously were brought up in a religious home by, you know, a seemingly very religious father, anyways, that I know of. Is there some guilt? Do you have any sadness around this?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to accept at first because when you're little, it's like your parents define your whole view of the world, and all I heard growing up was how this was wrong and evil and immoral, and so it was kind of hard to come to terms with. But I am religious myself, only I, you know, God, he's a God of love, and I don't think that he would create people and then hate them for who they were, so.
Maya Marcel Keys, we know, obviously, what your dad has said and how your dad feels about homosexuality. Is your mom in total lockstep with this? Did your mother ever have disagreements, certainly about your own sexuality, with your father?
No, my parents are pretty much the same, on the same page with this one.
Oh, okay, so they both had the same attitude. Did they want you to repress your sexuality? Did they want you to be straight? Exactly how did they put this to you?
Well, at first they were sort of in denial about the whole thing. They didn't really think I really was gay. They, I don't know, wanted me to realize my latent heterosexuality. But I guess once they sort of get more accepting of the fact that I am and it's not just going to go away if they ignore it, then they, A, got really more upset and angry about the whole thing, and B, sort of started telling me that I needed to either try and turn away or just, you know, be celibate for life, which, I mean, it's kind of amusing because I already am celibate, so I don't really know what the difference would be, but...
You are celibate.
Well, I mean, I'm only 19. I really don't think that sex is something that I need to be having in my life right now. It complicates everything. So... You know, it's sort of been something that I've always thought you should wait until you find the one person you want to spend your life with, whoever that is. So, you know, for the moment, yeah. But
so do you think,
I do hope to settle down and, you know.
Do you think that, you know, when you talk to your dad, I mean, do you think that at some point you're going to be able to maybe make him more accepting? Do you think that there's any way that he will start to sing a different tune as your relationship grows?
Oh, gosh, no, I really don't think so. His beliefs are very, you know, strong. But hopefully, eventually, this won't come in the way of, you know, I mean, obviously, it'll always be slightly in the way of our relationship because he'll be rejecting of, you know, a very fundamental part of who I am. But hopefully, it won't sort of totally end things.
Now, we know, of course, that you know, your father and mother, I guess, have stopped speaking to you. What about your siblings? You have two siblings, am I right?
Yes, I have two brothers, and they've both been really cool with me, so no, it's not the entire family.
It isn't? So they do stay in contact with you?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, you went to Illinois with your dad when he ran for the Senate last year?
Mm-hmm.
Did how did you feel when you heard him call Mary Cheney, Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter, who's a lesbian, a selfish hedonist? What was your immediate reaction when you heard that?
Well, it was sort of weird seeing it all over the news, but it wasn't anything I hadn't heard before at home, so I wasn't particularly surprised.
Really? In other words, your dad had told you that he felt homosexuals were selfish hedonists?
Yeah.
It seems like it must be a rough position to be in. You seem like you're being awfully kind about it. I mean, this is your dad. You said your dad was like an honest guy, but yet he wanted to conceal your sexuality from voters. I mean, how do you reconcile those two things?
Well, I mean, my sexuality—that's a private thing. It's not like it was an issue that needed to be told to everyone. I mean.
I guess. I mean, but it seems like when you're in a political family that stuff is going to happen, and it seems like, you know, like people like even as evil and weird as Dick Cheney are able to reconcile these things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah,
never,
I think
you,
so.
You know, so, but you just, do you ever talk, is there any sort of like, is there a small, is there a chat room for gay children of political personalities from the right?
Gosh, I don't think there is one yet.
Do you have any political aspirations yourself? You mentioned that your dad got really upset when you attended the counter-inaugural. I know you're only 19 years old, but, I mean, on a political level, do you ever think about, at some point, maybe in the future, running for elected office? Or has your father's experience with doing that soured you on the process?
No, I really have no intentions to do that myself.
What kind of stuff are you doing? Do you take? Are you active on a political level in any way?
Well, I'm active in terms of, you know, going to protests and things like that. But In actual running for office terms, it's not something that I'm very interested in.
How about gay issues? Do you do any work with the gay community?
Well, I've done volunteer work with different groups around D.C. and things, nothing huge yet. I mean, this speech was really the first big thing that I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully in the future I'll be able to continue that work.
Uh-huh. And do you talk with, I've read that you talk with other gay teens that have been kicked out of their houses.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of friends through the years who were homeless, and anyone who works at all with, you know, homeless youth realizes the huge disproportionate percentage of them that are LGBT kids. And so it's been an issue that I've been concerned about for a long time. These kids who, I mean, often are in positions where they've just been kicked out and rejected by their families because of who they are. And so I have had lots of experience with that and done some work with organizations around D.C. that help out gay kids. So...
Well, that's great. It's great to do that kind of work, you know, because this Republican, this particular administration in general, I mean, I read something about a suicide prevention lecture that was supposed to be given at...
And they refused to say the word gay when the whole, like, focus of the seminar was about gay kids. And
isn't that unbelievable?
Suicide.
Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, it was supposed to be gay, transsexual, bisexual, and transgender community who are very vulnerable to suicide in some respects. And they refused to let them say that.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty ridiculous.
It was awful. I mean, because basically they're saying, you know, why discourage them? You know, it's just an awful thing. And I mean, it's got to be kind of tweaky to have your father part of that same, you know, Republican machine that puts out this type of propaganda against homosexuality. You got to be a little pissed off, aren't you?
Yeah, it's not easy.
Okay. Well, you know, we really appreciate you chatting with us today. And I wish you all the luck with everything that you embark in, you know, hopefully, you know, making your father more accepting of your lifestyle and thus, you know, conversely, the lifestyle of other gay people.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right, Maya Marcel Keys, great talking to you. You have a great day. We will be back with the liberal agenda after this. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio. It's Morning Sedition. Man, we took it to the afternoon on Friday, Riley.
Yes, we did.
I don't know how many of our listeners heard that, but we hosted Randy Rose's show on Friday, and we had a good time.
I really enjoyed it.
And we hope you enjoyed the best of. We put that specially together for you because we knew we had to host Randy's show because Randy is ill, but she's getting better. She's at home and she's recovering nicely. And I'd never met a lot of her production
her people.
Team
her
or her audience. And 4 hours was certainly an exciting long haul. And it was Friday and they wanted us to you know, keep it light and entertaining and plow through it. And I had a great time.
And we did all of the above.
We did.
Absolutely did all of the above.
Did some good calls. It was cool to work in the afternoon. I got to be honest with you, man.
Well, I'll never hear the words bounce your boobies and not think of that song, that's for sure, which I had never really heard before.
I never heard it at all, and it was such an important thing. I mean, that was the big discussion leading up to it. It's like, how are they going to engage with Bounce Your Boobies? Because Bounce Your Boobies is a Randy Rhoads
staple,
and we need to know how Mark and Mark are going to handle the Bounce Your Boobies song.
Yeah.
But it was a good time. And I was at Symphony Space last Thursday. I want to thank all the listeners that came out for that. I think we had an interesting evening. We covered some
I gave
topics.
A Black History presentation yesterday, too.
We talked about that. You were going to go do that on Friday, The Secret Life of Mark Riley.
Yeah.
How'd that go?
It was great. It was at the Presbyterian Church of Teaneck. A lot of Morning Sedition listeners and fans. A lot of your fans were there.
Come on.
Yeah, I'm serious.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how'd you lay it out? Because I remember you were sort of, you weren't divulging a lot about how you were going to present your lecture, and I was curious. I was asking for details.
Well, my essential thrust about Black History Month is that folks have to be about the business of making their own history.
Okay.
Not just looking at the month as something that you study or something that you learn about or you hear about Dr. King and Abe Lincoln and George Washington Carver or whoever, but that you sow the seeds, particularly in young people, of the ability to make history.
Mm.
And that's Black history, American history, world history, whatever it is. There have been so many young people, the young people in South Africa, for example, that instigated the Soweto Uprising in 1976. Those were young people who didn't want to learn Afrikaans in their classrooms. That's how that whole thing started.
That's, and we need that now. That's some of the discussion we were having about earlier in, when I was talking to my wife just about when Hunter S. Thompson died, is that there's a rebel spirit that is necessary to democracy.
Well, yeah.
That I fear is dissolving in young people. That they no longer have a context, which I think in some respects is great when Black History Month happens and you go out and it gives you the impetus to go out and talk under the umbrella of Black History Month is a reason to to reawaken people, because sometimes kids just don't have a context. And I think that one of the reasons Black History Month was put into place in the first place was to create, to make sure that the context survives and is and reminds people.
Yeah, and see, part of the problem, Mark, is, and I know this as a kid myself, once upon a time, long, long ago, a lot of today's young people don't want to hear a constant litany of this is the way it was back in the 60s. Okay? They weren't a glimmer in their parents' eye in the 60s.
I know.
They want to know what's happening now. And if the 60s can help them navigate the 21st century, then it's cool. And where we've broken down, and I say this as a member of the baby boom generation, is that we, as you very correctly point out, have not always provided the right context to say to people, this is how what happened in the 60s is applicable in the 21st century. And when you look at a Republican president, both houses of Congress being Republican, the whole idea of pushing all of these different programs, whether it's privatizing Social Security or whatever, people say, well, wait a minute, what lessons should be learned from the 60s? Look at what this guy's doing now. He controls everything.
Why the spirit of dissent is essential to democracy is what has to be learned from the 60s.
Yeah, and see, that's why a lot of people are so upset, I think, and why I'm upset, certainly, about Hunter Thompson dying.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was a renegade dissenter. I mean, he wasn't, he was, against the hippies in some respects and against, he was his own thing, but he was a renegade voice, and he was certainly, an incredible, critic of politics, and of culture. And, and it was that spirit of dissent that drove it and blew my mind.
And an iconoclast to the bone, and of course, Malcolm X was killed at 3:10 p.m. 40 years ago today, right here in New York City.
Also an iconoclast to the bone.
Yes, also an iconoclast, a man who grew up as a pimp, as a hustler, and who changed history.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, that spirit has to remain. And in the name of that spirit, we will take our liberal agenda from the Hunter S. Thompson compound. Today's phrases are to drop in the conversation are all from the doctor, Hunter S. Thompson. One, call on God, but row away from the rocks. Two, the edge. There is no honest way to explain it because the only people who really know where it is are the ones who have gone over. So write us soon, please, doctor. Three, I have a theory that the truth is never told during the 9 to 5 hours. That's right, and look what time it is. Exactly. Four, America, just a nation of 200 million used car salesmen with the money, all of the money we need to buy guns and no qualms about killing anybody else in the world who tries to make us uncomfortable. And five, I hate to advocate drugs, alcohol, violence, or insanity to anyone, but they've always worked for me. R.I.P. Hunter S. Thompson, we're going to miss you.
Absolutely.
I'm going to go read some Hunter today just to celebrate his life.
Yep, and tomorrow we're going to have film historian Donald Bogle, brilliant, brilliant man. He's the author of Bright Boulevard, Bold Dreams, the story of Black Hollywood. He will discuss that with us tomorrow.
Looking forward to it.
Extraordinary guy. Looking forward to it. Have a good one, Maron.
You too, Riley.
Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. Hi.